I'm Brandon Bartnick, and this is the Future of Mobility Podcast.
The Future of Mobility Podcast is focused on the pursuit of safe, sustainable, effective, and accessible transportation of goods and people. Given the critical nature of the world's climate and energy needs, these topics have never been more important, and they're certainly important to me. So, this podcast is a weekly interview series in which I learn from and put the spotlight on the people helping to develop and implement the technology required to move us forward. Who am I? As mentioned, my name is Brandon Bartnick, and I'm an engineer who realized that making a positive impact is the most important thing to me, both through this podcast and my career in the industry. If you're passionate about any of the topics I cover here, please feel free to reach out on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to connect. Also, if you hear anything you like, please consider sharing the Future Mobility with a friend or colleague. This podcast is brought to you by Edison Manufacturing and Engineering. Technology innovation is great, but it doesn't mean anything if we can't bring our impactful products to life, which means we have to build them. And unfortunately, that's easier said than done, especially for startups and evolving companies that need a reliable option for low-volume builds. That's where we come in. Edison is your turnkey manufacturing partner, specializing in build and assembly of highly complex products in annual volumes of 10 to tens of thousands, utilizing an agile and capital-light approach. If you need a trusted manufacturing partner, then please visit us at edison-mfg.com or feel free to reach out to me directly at brandon.bartnick@edison-mfg.com or by visiting my LinkedIn page, Brandon Bartnick. Now to this week's episode. Today's guest is Laura Fox. Laura speaks on mobility, city, and climate topics globally, is on Transportation Power 100 and Top Women in Mobility list. She's co-founder and managing partner of Street Life Ventures, which is a seed stage venture fund investing in B2B urban climate solutions to transform sectors including mobility, buildings, energy, waste, and water. She also was the general manager of Citibike at Lyft and built that into a $100 million plus annual recurring revenue business and one of the largest transportation systems within the country and a bunch of other cool stuff that she's done. The focus today is around the urban aspect of the transportation challenge that we face, as well as the role that transportation and mobility plays within the greater challenges that we're facing within the urban ecosystem. So really fun discussion for me. I don't live in New York City or a dense urban area. I realize, you know, of course, not all transportation problems are urban, but the urban transportation challenge and the role that movement of goods and people play within urban environments, something we really need to figure out. And we unpacked that and talked about a bunch of fun stuff around that idea. So I'll leave the intro here. Please enjoy this conversation with Laura Fox. Today, I'm joined by Laura Fox. Laura, thanks for joining the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Brandon.
Yeah, really looking forward to this discussion. I think you bring an important and also a bit of a unique perspective in this overall mobility world that we are trying to solve and I guess trying to understand how to make things better as we serve the people that we're trying to serve. So would you mind, I guess, certain things off, introducing yourself and a bit about the work that you're doing?
Yeah, sure, of course. So my entire career has been focused on how you improve quality of life in cities while generating alpha from a private sector perspective. So I have advised cities on transportation and built environment issues from the private market's perspective. I've built mobility companies at BCG with their digital ventures group and launched them with corporates. I worked at Sidewalk Labs and did diligence on mobility and urban climate tech companies kind of across a wide spectrum. And then I was at Lyft and Citibike and led Citibike for 4 years as this general manager, you know, doubled the service area, grew it into an over 100 million ARR business. And now I'm the co-founder of Street Life Ventures alongside my partner, Sonam Balani. And at Street Life, we invest in B2B pre-seed and seed stage companies in the urban climate space and focus on five sectors. And those include mobility and logistics, so topic of our conversation today, buildings, energy, waste and water, and then adaptation-related technologies. And, you know, we decided to start Street Life to help founders grow and scale successful businesses in these spaces. And that, you know, after years in our day jobs, right, you know, working kind of in and out on both, you know, my background as an operator, Sonam working in finance and on the regulatory side, We really saw some core pain points when we were working with entrepreneurs in the urban climate mobility space, from navigating complex regulatory environments to how you build great business models and operating structures within these contexts, to getting, you know, first customers and then building and sourcing alternative kind of capital sources just outside of equity too. So grants, debt, all sorts of other things to help them really scale. So we really focus on helping companies scale and be successful from the earliest stages.
Cool. I appreciate that. And maybe slightly philosophical question to start of, like, so you mentioned kind of this North Star of improving life in a sitting setting. And I guess the question is, how do you take something big and abstract like that and try to dissect it? Now, I'll share maybe my perspective. And this is something that I'm struggling with kind of on a really in real time on a daily and weekly basis of, so I started this podcast, and a lot of my work is in making mobility better. And it's taken me, and I'm still kind of refining, okay, what does that actually mean? What does mobility mean? And I started with, you know, it's getting our cars and our vehicles better. And then I thought, well, that's incomplete. And I got to the point where now it's defined as a tagline here, which is safe, sustainable, effective, accessible transportation, which is movement of goods and people.
Yeah.
Pretty good. You're getting closer there. But I also, I don't think that's complete either. Because, like, the goal isn't necessarily to move people or things from place to place. I mean, that's, I guess, transportation. But as in some of the past discussions I've had on the podcast here recently has been around this point. Now what I'm believing is, well, mobility really is more about, it's the outcome. It's about providing access to and connecting people with the people, the things, the places that are meaningful for them and make life. But it's hard to do anything with that. So then I come back to, well, okay, I feel okay with this world that I've defined of safe, sustainable, effective, accessible transportation, realizing that it's incomplete, but also realizing that this is a big enough problem. And if you solve this problem while also thinking about the overall objective, you're making some meaningful progress. Long backstory, and I apologize for all that went into this, but, like, how have you thought about this problem? Like, you have this big goal and you try to dissect it into where can you actually make the biggest impact?
Yeah, I mean, to the point on this is a big problem, right? One of the reasons why for Street Life we focus on these dense urban contexts is because 50% of people live in cities and 70% of all emissions globally come from these dense urban areas. And, you know, when we talk about the impacts of climate, this is both a great financial opportunity, right? But it's also an area of great kind of impact, and we're starting to see the results of climate in our day-to-day lives, right? So it's no longer theoretical. We're seeing consequences of increased climate disasters, right? From coastal flooding in New York, you know, killer heat waves in Mumbai, and the list goes on and on. And it's impacting what we'd like to call the places that we call home, right? So this is becoming more and more present when we think about the problem statement that is not only cities, but cities as they move into the future. And so, you know, big problem statement, also big economic opportunity when we think about solving for and breaking down, to your point, those problem statements. And maybe before I get to breaking down those problem statements, I think that, like, you're speaking to what's the function of, like, moving people, what's the function of moving goods. And I think that there are so many different approaches and frameworks that you can use to talk about that, right? And so many different ways of approaching it. And the point that you mentioned towards the end, you know, really hit home for me, because I worked with someone named Alain Berthaud when I was getting my MBA. I went to NYU for my MBA because I did an urbanization project in their business school. So I was able to work with a number of cities globally, and specifically with Alain. And then after my MBA, when I was at BCG, I edited Alain's book On the Weekends, which is not a great work-life balance recommendation for anyone, but was really fun regardless. But his book's called Order Without Design. And he really frames up, and I believe in this also, that, you know, cities are labor markets, right? And the, you know, ways that transportation is most effective is to kind of connect people to jobs, right, as a main source of income from their home. And that, you know, a city can be judged by its efficiency by the maximum number of jobs as a percentage that are reached by the largest percentage of people, right, within an hour long commute. And so I think that that's one lens of looking at cities. I think then, you know, from a completely different lens for, you know, anyone deep within the urbanist space, I think that there's, like, a equity and accessibility, right, angle to all of that, of course, right, based on how cities have been designed in the past. and would really encourage people to read another great book, which is called The Color of Law, which essentially, you know, is looking backwards but saying, you know, what's, you know, what has worked, what has not worked, who has access, who doesn't. And then especially when we think about who is most impacted by climate change today, what decisions did we make in the past that have led to those results that disadvantaged communities are seeing those biggest impacts? So a lot of different ways to even frame the central purpose of what a city is. But then how do we take those big problem statements and break them down, right? We have particular theses per each of our verticals, right? So mobility and logistics, buildings, energy, waste and water, and adaptation. And are specifically looking for problem statements that solve for pain points in not just one city, but multiple different cities, right? And so looking for those biggest, what we like, friction points and unmet needs. So that could be anything from something that's more linked to the bigger space, like multifamily EV charging, and solving that problem and pain point, or it could be linked to things like the logistics network that we see today and the pain points that are caused by that. And so really think about it as technologies and solutions that can solve for pain points across urban areas, not just one.
And how big does something need to be considered a city within this lens, or what are the characteristics and how much variance, like, right? I think you're in New York City, I'm in the Detroit area. How different are those problem statements?
Yeah, they're pretty different as problem statements. And I think that this gets to a lot of how you as an entrepreneur might think about growing if you're thinking about expanding within an urban footprint. So, you know, one thing that we counsel entrepreneurs on a lot is that bigger cities can actually be really hard to pilot and do your early scaling and testing in because they're really complicated, right? So a city like New York that has some interesting dynamics to it, like, you know, high degrees of density, right? Large amounts of transit access, things like that. If you're targeting pain points that link to cities like that, actually starting in the biggest version of that is not great because there's eight different agencies that you have to coordinate with and they'll all want to know where you did it before. Meanwhile, you have smaller cities, but still sizable, like even within the New York area, I think about a city like Hoboken or New Jersey, where the kind of, you know, governmental kind of organization structure is a lot flatter. You can really interact with pretty senior levels of government from the beginning as a startup founder, and then kind of test your product at a decent scale there, prove it out at a city scale, you know, granted a much smaller city scale, and then take that to some of the larger cities and say, hey, this worked, right? And so I think that the idea of, you know, cities are not homogenous, right? Each of them is different. But taking a strategic approach when you think about a product or service in terms of what do I need to have as baseline, and then identifying large cities and smaller cities that meet those criteria as you think about a scaling strategy, I think is something that boils down effectively for kind of a startup and a startup founder.
Yeah. And how... So many questions running through my head. So like a related one here is like how streamlined, or how do you work with a startup founder? And feel free to share examples if you have any, if it makes sense, but not no obligation, of course. But like if you're working with a startup founder, how do you figure out what's the right size problem to bite off, and how wide the boundary can? Because like right, we talk about this is a huge problem. It's hard to make. You can't solve all the problems at the same time. So like, how do you try to find that balance, and how do you coach startup founders to solve the right type and size of problem?
Yeah, it's a great question. Maybe I'll give two examples of that. You know, I think that from one perspective, like in general, and maybe broad statement first, I think startup founders get excited, and all of us get excited about solving big problems, right? And problems that have the ability to impact a lot of people, a lot of different places. And I think that that is really incredible and exciting ambition. And then I think in one dynamic, it's, you know, what's your perspective on a big problem that allows for you to solve it better, faster, cheaper, right? So maybe one startup to call out there that I've known for a long time is a company called VotePost. And, you know, they're a curbside EV charger charging company. And curbside charging is a known big knotty problem when we look across the United States, right, where we need 1.2 million curbside EV chargers, but only have something like 150,000. I had a really funny moment where I was in Jeju Island in Korea last year. It's a very small island in the south. It has about a population of 700,000 people. And I was walking around, I said to my husband, I'm like, I'm pretty sure that there are definitely more curbside EV chargers here than in all of New York City. And we looked it up. It turns out there are three times the number of curbside EV chargers in tiny Jeju Island, population of 700,000, than New York City, obviously a population of 8 to 10 million based on how you're sizing it. So obviously we are lagging, right, in rolling out that infrastructure. But then the kind of more nuanced perspective is we're lagging because it's so expensive in the United States to do curbside EV chargers. The cost of doing an average trench in most American cities is something like $100,000 based on utility coordination, government coordination, all these kind of layered dynamics. And so Volpost, you know, took a look at that problem and said, hey, there's a way that we can do this 90 to 95% cheaper and enable a bunch of other great use cases for a city, which is retrofitting existing city lampposts for EV charging, which, you know, uses, you know, 10%, 5% of the make ready dollars that a trench would use from a hardware perspective, right? It's, you know, kind of affixing to an existing environment. And then cities with that upgraded electricity infrastructure to their existing hardware, i.e. lampposts in the city, they can install 5G towers, which they are sorely lacking, right? And every 5G kind of company and wireless technology company is scrambling to try to figure out positioning for them. They could install things like curb monitoring, traffic monitoring, air quality monitoring, all these other use cases that actually enable a city to be better and work better, right? So I think that that's an example of taking a really big, really challenging problem and just taking a different perspective that allows you to do it better. I think on an alternative perspective, I mean, I think, you know, there have been times where I've met entrepreneurs who have a deck and an idea and they're like, I want to tackle middle mile logistics transportation, and I'm going to own all of the and buy all of the EV trucks. I'm going to install all of the infrastructure, and I'm going to build the software layer that it enables all of this to be done more efficiently. And that's a huge amount of vertical integration that comes with completely different types of cost and CapEx structures, different types of skill sets within a company, right? From software development to basically, you know, incredibly detailed project finance, real estate structuring, policy and infrastructure deals. And so I think with founders who come with that vision, it's like, okay, that's really exciting. Let's go a little bit deeper on where you start, right? So like, what's the thing that's the biggest pain point today? How can you get started? What's a minimal viable version of kind of kicking off this big ambition? Is there anyone that you could partner with as, say, an infrastructure provider when we're thinking about like another level of it in terms of the, you know, fleet EV trucking charging, right? Which is a big pain point in the ecosystem in general today, right? And so I think that there's a lot of like taking that big ambition, then breaking it down into a chunk that is manageable, has a real market in the short term that you can build against and continue to show kind of traction and progress on, while considering whether doing things like taking out, you know, 5-year leases just to build up all of the, you know, permitting required to ready a site for EV charging is something that makes sense for the business I'm going.
Yeah. And I didn't expect necessarily to dive this deep, but I already have at least one and maybe two follow-up questions. And,
okay.
And it's a similar vein here. So how the overall topic is competition. And I have a hard time trying to figure out how to think about this, especially in a situation like you, that second situation you drive for, like whoever this is, they're not the first person to ever think about solving middle mile logistics. There's lots of people who have thought about this problem and who are probably actively working on it from different areas, whether it's the big companies who are providing the service right now, maybe the vehicle providers, maybe other startups, maybe. And I mean, yeah, maybe a part of this is a therapy session because I'm going through the process of building a startup myself. But like depending on how you, at least for us, and I think for a similar situation, depending on how you draw, like you compete with everyone because like you're going after a big problem. Like you have big aspirations, and within the Venn diagram of problems you're trying to solve, there's almost always overlap. But that doesn't feel right to me because I think there's almost always a bigger pie out there. And by collaborating
the two or three or however many parties can solve bigger problems than any one company can. But the natural inclination is, and I don't know where it comes from in business culture or what, but like the natural inclination is to be shy of anyone who might be sniffing around the same area that you're playing in. How do you think about that general concept and try to advise thinking about that?
Yeah, like the general concept of co-opetition. I mean, I think that there is a sense of, especially if you're an early stage startup, how can you partner with people who potentially, like, I think that this second example is a great one to dig into, because how can you partner with people who might bring a different level of expertise, assets, talent to the table than you do? So for example, on the big fleet EV trucking infrastructure, there's a lot of big infrastructure PE firms and others who are targeted on this space. But one of their main problems holding back investment is knowledge that there will be significant utilization on the routes that they're creating, right? And so could you go out and identify who is willing to make an investment based on utilization and essentially then be looking to create routes, right, with the, whether you're delivering parcels or goods or a whole set of other services along those routes, and thinking about how you're electrifying different route structures, right? And building kind of a software tool that allows you to be the most efficient at those routes, and the infrastructure investments kind of following that. So I think that that's actually a great example for that. I think it gets more complicated if you're a startup that has an attribute that a bigger company could potentially build, and that they already own the customers. I think that's one to be navigated, you know, effectively and well, because there's a potential for M&A in that context, right? And so that could be a great exit for you, especially if you like that larger corporate, but you don't want them to get too close too early, right? While you're kind of going through that early R&D and really building up your own product base. And so that's something where, you know, for example, we like to think about a CVC that is affiliated to the corporate that could bring, you know, potential M&A in the future or potential incremental sales channels for a particular customer type as being a great investor at a Series A or Series B, because they could help supercharge growth in advance of, say, a purchase. But, you know, if that CVC, you know, invested maybe at a pre-seed, that could be a little bit more challenging in terms of the company feeling completely comfortable sharing, you know, the very early stages of their growth and development and all those other components. And so I think that there's a strategic structuring part of this and also a bit of a timing angle in that second example.
Yeah, that all makes sense. Appreciate the context. I think there's lots more that could be explored in that vein, but maybe we come back, but I guess transitioning back to it. So you mentioned these five areas that you're focusing on. Mobility and, well, maybe first, adaptation. What do you mean by adaptation? That's been, could you unpack that one real quick?
Yeah, of course. I mean, adaptation is really the response to a changing, like, planet. Like, we are seeing, like, more flooding. We're seeing heat increase. I think we're seeing on the flooding side too much water. Then there's instances of too little water when we look at things like groundwater crises, how we use water more effectively. And then there's like how all of these things then impact the built environment and different assets and things like that. And so, you know, one company and investment that we've made to highlight is a company called Rhizome. And, you know, we're obviously focused as a fund on decarbonizing buildings, decarbonizing transportation systems, right? Using that new renewable energy sources, et cetera. But all of that and the entire conversation that we're having nationally around that depends on having a clean, reliable, and abundant electrical grid and electrical supply. And none of those things are true today in the United States, right? Like, very much not true. So 90% of energy that comes into cities is dirty. On the reliability side, the U.S. leads all countries globally on a stat that we should never want to win on, which is the largest number of power outages on a per capita basis, which is 90% of that is driven by climate-related kind of disasters. And then on the abundance side, we, you know, need to grow energy supply significantly to meet the demands of all this electrification. And that means significantly growing, you know, 3-4x-ing our renewable energy supply that exists today. And so really interested in all of those kind of underlying components. And Rhizome specifically tackles that reliability standpoint. So they map out climate risks as it exists today, map that into the future, and then work with utilities to map utility infrastructure assets onto that map and make a bunch of cost-benefit scenarios based on different interventions that utilities could make on their infrastructure to make it more climate resilient. So that could be, you know, above ground or below ground in the cases of like extreme wind, wildfires, like all of those kinds of instances. It could be related to hardening as it relates to flooding. And then you weight that against the likely climate disaster, as has been shown through the infrastructure and utilities' own assets in the past. And so it's a really great solution that is saying, hey, our environment is changing and it's adapting. Utility companies today are spending $50 billion nationally to solve for climate-related resilience and adaptation-related issues, but they're doing it a little bit blind, or they're paying consultants a significant amount of money. And there's a $500 billion gap. So Rhizome helps them do it much smarter, right, as they're planning out those big infrastructure investments so they can avoid those larger disasters in the future.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the context and clarification. And it certainly makes sense that that's an area to be focusing on, given the reality of the situation we're in now. And I think you uncovered something I wanted to touch on as well there. So like in the situation you described, right, of like the electrical grid, the infrastructure, there's a gap. And part of the solutions that are being deployed in other areas, think about energy as well as mobility and logistics, are contingent on that gap being closed at some point adequately to actually reach their full potential. So then speaking specifically like electric vehicle rollout and implementation, right? So like you need to be able to charge more vehicles, you need to be able to do it cleanly and reliably and do it in a way that doesn't detract from the electrical needs of the other aspects of society and of a city. How do you think about, because like there's two different camps that you could have. One is, well, there's this big gap, so we can't get into electrification. We need to tiptoe around there, and we need to think of electrification as part of the solution, but we can't rely on it. The other gap is, well, or the other approach is, well, we're going to figure out all that stuff, and we're doing good work there, and eventually it's going to be good, so like let's lean into electrification because we got enough problems to solve here. It's probably somewhere in between there of reality, but how do you think about trying to find that balance?
I mean, I think that there's no path forward but to heavily lean on electrification, right? And so it's more of like by leaning into electrification, we create entirely net new markets for renewable energy, like in all sorts of other demands, right? And so private markets will work as private markets will work. And so I think continuing to lean in that direction. But that doesn't mean that in the short term that we're unaware of the constraints and challenges, I guess, that we're faced with. You know, another company to call out that is related to the electrification infrastructure is called GoPower EV. And they do, they're based in California, and they do EV charging for multifamily residential, which is a pretty tricky proposition today because the standard path is to put in two Tesla fast chargers and upgrade the building's electricity system, which is a really expensive proposition for most multifamily housing properties, especially the electricity upgrade. And GoPower has a lower cost model, and they do it on a per space basis. So rather than everyone fighting over those two EV chargers that are available, they do a per space model that's relatively cheap and level one. And so low cost hardware. And then they also have a software layer to that, which I think gets to this point, which essentially, you know, as someone, you know, plugs in their EV at the end of the day, it'll ask them, when do you next need to drive and how far? And essentially creates a queuing system on the back end such that overnight when rates are cheapest, kind of non-peak hours, the building has the most capacity, everyone's EV are being charged based on their need for the next day. And so I think that that's a great example of a company that is thinking about the kind of consumer level implications, right, of, you know, peak energy versus non-peak being such a widespread right now in a lot of different markets. And also the building owners and the real estate developers who would have an extreme cost to kind of make major infrastructure upgrades on their property. So, and I think that there's a lot of other examples like Amp Control and others that do this for fleets and at point of charge there for larger infrastructure plays where we have to be conscious in the short term of those constraints while we continue to push on the electrification front.
Yeah, cool. Definitely plenty of room for innovation in that space as well. And so you've already touched, I imagine, on aspects of this, but so within the mobility and logistics world, what is how do you describe kind of the core thesis that you know, that Street Life holds, and where are you looking for the biggest opportunities to make an impact?
Yeah. You know, within mobility, we're really focused beyond big EVs and the climate transition. It's big EVs are a crowded market. And also, I think, given how dirty the electricity grid is now in big cities, right, really kind of focused on other levers. And so related to that thesis, you know, we need more infrastructure investment, more kind of this fundamental reimagining, I guess, of the status quo and a number of other things. You know, have struggled in the past of having a framework that connects the vocabulary about these changes across investors, startups, government, and a whole range of others. And so the mental model that I've long had in place and that we've really integrated into the fund is a stack that we call the MORE framework. And so there's four key layers to it, and I'll just talk about it in reverse order, that really go across the kind of stack of needs on the mobility side. So first is the enablement side. So allowing government, business, individuals to, you know, assess, plan, and measure for mobility intervention. So that could be everything from congestion reduction, climate mitigation, use of streets during certain times of day, different modes, movement of people, movement of goods. Second is rebuild. There's a pretty staggering stat from the Rockefeller Foundation that states that 75% of the urban infrastructure needed by 2050 does not exist today. You know, a lot of that is in developing markets. That's partially true in developed markets. Many developed markets, we need to just reimagine how we are using those streets. So infrastructure there can be actually a digital infrastructure layer, like managing streets in different ways, to physical infrastructure, you know, from sustainable concrete to electrification. There is for offer. So, you know, different mobility solutions that help move people and goods, be it, you know, the microtransit delivery, lightweight vehicles, like a whole range of different options. And then last one is this maintain layer, which is the M in the MORE framework. I know like a lot of people don't like to talk about maintenance because it's not quote unquote sexy. As someone who used to run, you know, an urban transportation network at Citibike of 30,000 bikes that break and have issues and constantly kept me up at night. Maintenance, I think, is an incredibly sexy and important topic and one of the most important ones, right? Whether that be kind of maintenance of the physical goods or kind of maintenance of this connection to larger constraints, like what we were talking about with Amp Control or what GoPower EV is doing with the queuing system. Happy to talk about companies and examples that fit against that framework too, but that's a little bit about how we think about thesis for mobility.
Yeah, thanks. That's helpful. And I mean, I guess I don't know if there's anything here or not, but come back to, again, maybe back to the therapy session, but like thinking about, so the day job, the work I'm doing with Edison is specifically focused on manufacturing. So we're contract manufacturer. Yeah. We build stuff for people. Yeah. And a lot of the companies we're working with help to solve these safe, sustainable, effective, accessible transportation stuff, which yeah, feels good when that's aligned. I also, though, have a belief that, like as I mentioned, that's just a small piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. Also, like I generally think, you know, it's not more vehicles or different vehicles that are going to solve the problem. There's a bunch of software and we need to rethink the way we move and the way cities are, like the stuff that you've been talking about, right?
Yeah.
I also believe that generally we don't need to buy more stuff. There's a tension that I feel, right, of like, on the one hand, feel really good as an enabler for a lot of the companies that are working towards this thing that I care about, which is making mobility serve its function better in the world. At the same time, like, it's not 100 out of 100 perfect alignment at all time. Maybe the question I'm trying to ask is, like, I don't know, in something like this, of like, you pick out an aspect of this framework, a startup goes and they try to solve that. You also need to go where the business is. Like, how do you try to navigate that potential misalignment over time that could come up of like, hey, here's this highfalutin goal that you're going after, and then here's how you build a big business, which allows you to spend, you know, 80% of your time doing the thing that you care about, but also, like, you got to do other stuff to make money. I don't know if that question makes sense or not.
I think so. I mean, all these companies are set up to make money, right? Because I think for us, we're a climate fund where we focus on returns being the best drivers of impact, right? Because in order to have this impact that everyone wants to have on the world, you have to build a sustainable business that is growing, right? And seeing like future development. I think that there's probably a interesting question that's below that though, where it's like, who else do you need to have involved to be successful? And like, where are their dependencies? Like, I think that there are things like, just an example that we talked about earlier, GoPower EV, right? That's a pretty clear B2B business model, right? They're selling to businesses, upgrading that. So there aren't a lot of, you know, necessarily other players outside of the utilities related to that, if all of a sudden there wasn't enough energy being delivered. And then there's examples where the work of public sector can be a major accelerant to the growth and development of a company, right? As one potential lever. So a company within the logistics chain that does both middle mile and last mile, to give a shout to, that's based in London, is called Hived. And they cover both and provide logistics services in that middle and last mile. They also have a software layer that they're onboarding a bunch of e-commerce companies onto. And the last mile in particular, you know, throughout the UK as their dominant market, is really focused on lighter electric vehicles, smaller vehicles, urban consolidation centers, things like that. They've been very successful since launch. And part of the wider policy ecosystem there is that, you know, London, you know, prior to that, and has been scaling up something called an ultra low emission zone, where, you know, they've essentially done something like congestion pricing, similar to what, you know, New York has been planning for 10 years, maybe we'll finally do at some point. But they've proven out like a really clear kind of private, public-led business model and structure that works. And that when London implemented the ultra low emission zone, they saw something like 80% of people change modes, right? So away from driving individual vehicles and creating a lot of congestion and slowing down streets, to then, you know, now 40% of people at peak hours are riding a bike, something like 50% are taking public transit or walking. And like the number of people who are driving individual vehicles is much smaller. And the revenues from that have allowed London to invest in bike lanes, bus lanes, like increased transit systems and things like that. So there's an overall kind of push within that environment to decarbonize transportation from that regulatory framework. And so I think that Hived has, you know, been super, like it has been, they're solving a major pain point that exists in a lot of cities. I think they could be successful in a ton of different environments, but that policy framework and structure has helped supercharge that growth, right? Because it's really aligned to the switch to much smaller modes, and you're seeing tons of increased efficiency from a lot of that work. So I think that's maybe one example of something versus, you know, maybe an example where, you know, without having that big, you know, some of those policy shifts, maybe it hasn't worked. You know, when I was at Citibike, you know, Citibike is owned by Lyft, so I work for Lyft, and really think that Lyft and, you know, a number of other rideshare providers did have a big ambition, and Lyft in particular, to get people out of individual vehicles, you know, taking these shared modes of transportation, and things like that. But there wasn't a bigger policy kind of lever that was kind of, you know, encouraging people to take shared modes, to take public transit, to take shared rides, right? Carpooling, things like that at that same time. And so I think the data has shown that like there was less success in getting people to give up individual vehicles at that same time because of that. And so, and it's not that Lyft and Uber and all these other rideshare companies haven't been successful, right? But did they have the impact on the urban area that they had hoped for? Right, is something that like is a little bit more challenging if you don't have the public sector kind of working hand in hand.
Yeah, and there's a later question here of like you mentioned something like congestion pricing or you know, having, I don't know, incentivizing certain modes of transportation or disincentivizing other modes.
Yeah.
And I've come to believe that that's a very important piece of it, and it's not. If anything, that's more fair because there are externalities and there are advantages that have been baked into our existing system that you don't see, but they should be accounted for in something like this. And by driving my vehicle, I am making, especially if it's a big vehicle, I'm making a negative impact on people around me. At the same time, I didn't have that view previously. I get the privilege of talking with people like yourself and learning and thinking through this. And so, especially if that impacted my day-to-day life and if I was in an environment like that, like, of course I would be upset about some new policy going in place. And at least initially I would be, that seemingly is unfair and that is taking away my freedom, which that's, even the word freedom there is complex in itself, and that the current system, if anything, is discouraging freedom. And but it's perceived as it's taking away your freedom. Like, how do you, I don't know, and any thoughts for how we navigate that? Of like, of course there's going to be a reaction that's ill-informed, but it's you have to be empathetic.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And I think that most people hate change, right? And so I think that anytime that change has been introduced, right, it's problematic, and people initially struggle to change a routine that was previously in place. I think it's just part of human nature, right? And in a lot of these initiatives in cities like London, you know, people in the early, you know, first couple of weeks who were surveyed were really upset. And then, you know, maybe if they had been surveyed a couple years later and London had done nothing, like with all the kind of revenue that they were making from the ultra low emission zone, if they hadn't reinvested into creating better public transit, if they hadn't invested in, like new rail lines, right? Like the Victoria line, which just feels like you're in a luxury train. I don't know. You've ridden it, it's incredible. If they hadn't invested in bike lanes, right? And you didn't feel as if you had viable alternatives that were cheaper, just as a good or better, maybe that would still be in place. But I think that London did make those investments, right? And showed that that was really possible. And at Street Life, we really believe that policymakers can be market makers, right? In their ability to set, if they're setting these restrictions thoughtfully, if they're incentivizing the private sector thoughtfully, and setting up the right dynamics there. So I think that there can be examples where there's a bit of friction, because there's always going to be what's called in urbanist circles, NIMBYs, not in my backyard. And that can apply to getting a bike lane on your block, or that can apply to like new housing going up, right? And a whole range of different issues that can ultimately be better for public good. Because, you know, I'm a private market capitalist, right, who's also an urbanist. And when you look at things like congestion costs cities like New York in the form of lost wages, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars per year. And so it's a major drag on overall GDP to kind of continue allowing the situation as it exists today. It's not extensible, right? The more people that move to already congested cities, like who then try to drive their individual vehicle, leads to even more, right? So it's a continuous problem. And again, if we get back to this idea that cities are labor markets, how do we kind of, you know, on the private market side, you know, invest in solutions, but also on the public market side, really support efficiencies there, I think is a critical question.
Yeah. And what role do you see Street Life playing in solving these problems that we've been talking about?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we left our beloved, comfortable operator roles to do this work because we think that you need to control the capital sources at the earliest stages to make a critical difference here. And so we have the perspective of having worked in these spaces our full careers, advised companies on these areas for decades, and really focus on tangibly and supporting in a couple different ways. First, so we invest in pre-seed and seed stage companies that are B2B focused, but, you know, are operating in these complex regulatory environments that we were just talking about, and climate and it is in and of itself a heavily regulated market. So, you know, examples of that are things like on-site energy storage, right, which you could use for EV charging, you could use it to power your home, things like that have to be approved by a department, they have to be approved by a fire department. It can get really complicated. And it can either be a complete blocker of you growing your business or an accelerator and almost a moat if you know how to navigate them. And so we really support companies there. You know, secondly, support companies on kind of operational experience. So folks that need to develop, what's your core business model? How do you think about growing that top line as to successfully scale? and pipeline? How do you think about setting up your operational base to be successful and think about unit economics? Really love to dig up, you know, roll up our sleeves there. You know, third area is like what we call networks that deliver the customer. So we both have a life's work Rolodex, right, in terms of real estate folks, OEMs, infrastructure players, and others that we love to connect startups to. And then we also have limited partners and the venture fund who have real estate assets themselves and are interested in the climate benefits, but especially the like saving costs, increasing value of those assets and all those different components. And then lastly, like we really help companies, you know, structure and scale the different parts of the capital stack that we were talking about briefly before, where, you know, equity is not the be all end all, right? There are lots of different ways to fund your company and fund that growth that are really critical, especially if you have a hardware element. So things like grants, but also these revenue-based debt, asset-based finance, and early project finance structures are really critical to setting yourself up for long-term success. And so work to bring those together. And so we think about our jobs as being the kind of de-risking and acceleration partners for startups that can really, you know, grow and scale and create this positive impact in our cities and on our climate.
Yeah, de-risking and acceleration. I guess that's a, yeah, that's a good way to summarize a ton of stuff that you guys are doing. Cool. So yeah, Laura, this has been a lot of fun. I think covered a lot of ground. I appreciate it. Definitely learned some things and connected a few dots while chatting here. So I really appreciate you joining. Maybe final question, anything you're hoping that someone listening to this takes away from the conversation?
I mean, I think it's just that there are so many different ways of tackling this problem. And I loved your point earlier about, you know, finding a perspective and finding an angle. And to me, that's why we developed that more framework, is to kind of lay out, it's not just about the vehicle, it's about the infrastructure, it's about the software enablement layers, it's about how we actually operate and run these systems. Mm-hmm. And each of them can have dramatically significant markets and pain points. And so just really encourage people who are listening to think about, you know, where is it that you feel like you, if you're thinking about starting a company, like where is it that you feel like you have a right to win? Like, what do you know? Where do you have kind of founder, kind of market fit? What is the problem that you feel curious about really going out and tackling? So I would say that piece. And just that these are the kinds of solutions I hope if people aren't working in this space and are thinking about it, that they, you know, are joining in droves in the coming years, because I think we're definitely in an all hands on deck moment from an impact perspective. But, you know, we look ahead, it's an estimated $5 trillion a year they're going to pour into the economy to get us to this net zero transition. And so it's an amazing economic opportunity for lots of folks too. So I think that that's where I think a lot of magic happens, where you have the huge ability to make impact and huge ability to make returns, and really seeing kind of entrepreneurs, founders, private markets, public sector folks coming together to create change here.
Yeah, cool. I think that's a great place to leave it. Well, Laura, thank you again. Best of luck to you and StreetLift.
Cool. Thank you so much, Brandon.
Well, there you have it. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Laura Fox. So what stands out to me? So first, and this is one of the things I struggle with, right? So I think often the transportation mobility challenge within especially mass media is boiled down to the two coasts, east, west coasts in the United States, at least. And it's focused, it's urban focused compared to, you know, the fact that not everyone is in an urban area, the vast majority of the country, especially from a geographic area, but I think even headcount, a lot of people are not living in cities, right? So the struggle with that a bit of, okay, does it make sense to be digging deep into urban mobility and the challenges we face in the urban space? And talking with Laura before this episode and then during this episode, it's resoundingly yes, I'm very glad to dive deep into this issue, because acknowledging the fact that the things we talked about in this episode are not all encompassing, they are super important, and they are one key aspect of the challenge that we need to face and overcome if we're going to make an improvement in the role, if we're going to make the improvement in the lives of the people that live here. And
transportation, as we talked about, is one aspect of what it means to have a thriving city and to have the opportunity for people to live fulfilling lives. And yeah, again, just wanted to acknowledge, because it's something that I struggle with. I'm not going to pretend, or would neither pretend, that the things that we covered here is all encompassing within the mobility world, but you need to be able to focus, as I talk about the importance of, you know, boundary conditions and use cases for different mobility technologies. Also, if you're going to have holistic solutions for transportation, you need to understand the unique scenarios in which you're solving those problems, and the urban environment is very different than non-urban environments. So that's the one key takeaway. And then, of course, the framework that we talked about is really interesting. I mean, Laura knows her stuff here. It's interesting to unpack the essence of what a city is, right? And the role that moving goods and people should and can play within that role, right? So it's not as simple as I talk about often in this podcast with different guests. Like, it's not about how do you make marginal improvements to the existing transportation modes and solutions that we have in place. The question is, how do we better solve the things? How do we meet the objectives that transportation and mobility are meant to meet within different environments? And how do you do that in the best way? And yeah, I know it's super abstract, but I think it's really important. We enjoyed this conversation. I really got a lot out of it. Hope you did too. As always, really appreciate listening. There's more to come next week.
Thank you for listening to the Future of Mobility.